All right, on today's podcast, we have Eliana Johnson. Eliana is the editor-in-chief of the Washington Free Beacon, and she's also been the White House correspondent at Politico, producer for Fox News, worked at National Review, and is all around a very knowledgeable person about what's going on in the media, as well as what's going on in D.C. So we're going to get some updates from her and hear some stories from her. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I hope I can live up to that.
I think you will. I think you will. Did I leave anything out there of the bio, anything that the listeners should know?
The only thing I would add is that my first job, because I think this is sort of forgotten, but my very first job out of college, which I took only out of desperation because I didn't have any other options, but was at the New York Sun, which is a small newspaper in New York that no longer exists, but a real newspaper covering New York City. And the Sun was this really incredible place founded by a legendary Wall Street Journal reporter, Seth Lipsky. And if you look at who, you know, the powers that be in the media now, a lot of them were at the Sun. So my colleague, Annie Carney, who's now covering the White House at New York Times, we actually worked together at the Sun. Ben Smith, the Times' media columnist, was at the Sun. Robert Messenger, who I'm not sure if he's still at the Journal, but he was sort of famous literary editor or arts editor at the Sun. They had they were well respected for their arts publication, but it was a wonderful experience just in that there was a lot of, it was a real incubator of talent, and there were a lot of interesting people of all different sorts and stripes in that small newsroom.
That reminds me of, I think it's the Washington City Paper. Is that the one that had like Jake Tapper and I want to say Maggie Haberman, like all these big names now. So that's like the New York City version of that. It was a big farm program.
Exactly.
Did you work for the student newspaper at Yale?
I didn't, which is why I think my Sun experience was shocking and interesting. I didn't work for the Yale Daily News. A lot of people come out. I think it provides really good training, but I didn't think I wanted to be a reporter. And so I just knew I wanted to be at the intersection of politics and writing. And so when I got to the Sun, they told me, your beat is higher education. That's what you cover. So, you know, let us know what stories you're going to do. And I didn't really understand what a beat was or what it meant. I remember Seth telling me, I'm supposed to be taking my sources to lunch and get in touch with this person. And when you write a negative story about someone, you take them to lunch the next day. And it was like a foreign language to me, and really, and it was a really sink or swim environment. So they just threw you into the deep end and saw if you could make it. And I ended up having a wonderful time there.
Now, you know, this is a podcast that is not critical of the media, but I do think it's really important to understand the intricacies of what you're talking about. And when you say, you know, working at Beat or taking sources out to lunch, you know, what does that mean? Like, how did you actually get that start? Like, you know, go cover higher education. I mean, obviously you probably have a good nose for what's newsworthy just inherently, but you know, what does that actually mean? Like working sources and working.
It's a good question. When I covered higher education, they gave me the contours. They sort of said, you should be focused on higher education issues of interest, either to New York City or nationally. So that's really like NYU, Columbia, the CUNY and SUNY schools, City University of New York, State University of New York, and the Ivy League, and you know, schools like Stanford that I think are of broad interest. So it did help. I graduated from Yale in the spring of 2006 and started at the Sun in the fall of 2006. And I think it helped having gone to Yale, just because I was privy to some, you know, some newsy things happening on campus and to the Ivy League more broadly, that because it's the Ivy League, people care about. And so a lot of my stories at the Sun were about the Ivy League, but also about Columbia and the New York schools. But it's really bringing attention to what's happening in these, I think, you know, 15 years out, we now know that what happens at these schools trickles down not only to other schools, less elite schools, but also to the rest of the country, and that they're, you know, they're incubating and beginning these trends. And people are always sort of interested, I think, in what's happening in New York City and in the Ivy League. So that was my mandate. Building sources was a different thing that I don't think I ever really understood when I was at the Sun, but it's a type of networking, but where people are telling you things they're usually not supposed to tell you. And there's a sense of trust that you're not going to violate the pledge of anonymity that they're telling you if they don't want their name to be used. But it's really networking with an eye towards getting information that's of use to the broader public and developing this relationship of trust with people. And so when my young reporters now ask me, like, how do I build sources? I tell them, well, you have a network now. And when you talk to people, I always would ask people, who else should I talk to about this? And that gives you a way to continue to broaden out your network through people that you already know. I think it's very hard to just ask people cold to talk about something sensitive.
I mean, what is usually the incentive for those sources to actually speak with journalists?
It depends. You know, covering the White House, a lot of the news that came out was a product of factional warfare in the White House. So if the president's made a decision, and I just read Susan Glasser and Peter Baker's biography of James Baker, and you could see him doing this, it's one way to change a decision made by the president or that's going to be made is to leak information about it and create public controversy about something. So certainly that's one motivation. But I remember my colleague Tim Alberta said that a mentor had said this to him once, but that you always have to think about people's motivation for telling you something they're not supposed to be telling you, and that it's really useful to keep that in mind. And some of the other, you know, useful tips I've gotten are, even if you can't talk to the person, you're right, if it's a story that puts somebody in a negative light, you have to at least ask yourself, like, what's the best case response that this person would give me, and try to account for that.
That's where my mind goes, is that, you know, journalists have distribution, right? I mean, I think longtime listeners of this podcast, 12 episodes in now, know that I'm a little bit obsessed with distribution. And so that's my thought, is that, you know, someone wants to get something out and that they go through the channels of the media who already have the distribution built out. And then I think that, you know, the big question is how do you, as a journalist in that seat, as you just alluded to, how do you parse that information? I mean, because what if someone gives you something that's a newsworthy tidbit, but you also know that, you're being played, so to speak, that this person just wants to get that out. You know, how does a journalist deal with kind of those malleable issues of maybe this is newsworthy, but it's not necessarily in the best intentions, or the opposite? Maybe, you know, it's bad intentions, but not newsworthy. I mean, how does that whole sausage making come to fruition?
I see a lot of bad intentions, but not newsworthy come across my desk, I think, right now. But it's a really good question. And I think you don't want to write press releases for people, which is something I think we see some people fall into. But it's usually about an argument over an issue or a person. And I think it's incumbent, and I think we see this less and less in the press, to fairly present both sides and not to caricature one side the way that the opposition might, but to look for the general public. It is useful and good to know the contours of debates that are happening in the White House, and to be able to elucidate that, I think, is very useful. And it doesn't necessarily serve the purpose of one over the other. Look, I'm sure you won't be shocked to hear, a lot of times people miscalculate what's going to be, like, how these things are going to play.
From my whole point of view, I think that, you know, distribution in terms of the business media is going to go direct, wholesale. Every business is going to have a media arm, and they're going to be talking directly to customers, and they're just not going to sit for Wall Street Journal or Fortune magazine interviews, knowing that, you know, the journalist is just going to look for something that's newsworthy that may not be in their best interest. But I think with the political media, it's certainly different, because politicians as entities, they come and go. I mean, they're quite ephemeral when compared to a business. And then in terms of the actual role of journalism, then you get into the whole public service aspect, right? I mean, when you talk about the media in terms of covering like tech companies, it's like, I mean, that really is just like fan service and leveraging somebody else's name to drive traffic. But in terms of unearthing
sometimes,
information,
right? Like, so sometimes it's that, but other times, like if there is a debate happening within the tech world or a trend emerging in tech, like that's actually useful information to the public, I would think.
I would agree. I would agree. But I think like Bad Blood, the John Carreyrou, I'm going to mess up his name, but like, you know, exposing like what was going on at Theranos is obviously the example, but I think that that's the anomaly in the set. I think that what you'll see is that more and more people will describe the type of technologies or new technologies that you're talking about just direct. Like, I think that people in industry will talk about that. Whether or not you need someone to parse that, you know, that remains to be seen. But I think for the public service aspect, you know, I think that we're returning to basically the time of the founding, where there was just party press and each, you know, politician or party had their own newspaper and that's how it functioned.
Totally agree with that.
Okay. So if you agree with that, you know, how does the kind of 20th century idea of, you know, objective journalism, unearthing things that are wrong with government and bringing that information to light, you know, what happens to that paradigm?
A couple things. I totally agree with your analysis. We're seeing, you know, I run a conservative publication. I know what it is to run an ideologically driven publication. And so I know when I see what the mainstream is doing, that that is what they are doing. They are, whether they know it or not, these are ideologically driven publications where many of the reporters, not all, but many have reached a conclusion and are finding the fact set to fit that conclusion. Having said that, look, I run a partisan outlet. Do we nonetheless break real news? You know, our eye is trained on Democrats and we bring real news. We break real news about Democrats. And so I actually don't think that like information that the public will suffer, because there will be left-wing outlets reporting aggressively on Republicans and there are right-wing outlets reporting aggressively about Democrats. What we're losing is the ostensibly mainstream press that claims not to be ideologically driven, but in fact is. And I actually think it may be useful to drop the pretense. That's what happened in the Trump era. Like, of course, neutrality and even-handedness was always an aspiration. It was never a reality. And a lot of people will say, oh, there's no such thing as being unbiased. And yes, but like the goal was that you should strive to be that way. And I think in Trump, you know, the media came under so much pressure to condemn his actions that they just dropped the veil. And it became very clear where they stood on issues as opposed to presenting the best case of both sides to the public.
There's also the business aspect, right? I mean, I think if you look at the New York Times, there's nothing more obvious. In fact, I looked at the New York Times this morning. I mean, I checked their homepage not infrequently, and it kind of hit me today that the entire homepage was just completely irrecognizable compared to what it would have been even 5 years ago. It was just like a completely different entity. And the New York Times, obviously, I mean, they've lost a majority of their advertising. They've continued to lose it in every single quarterly report, which I'm sad to say I've actually read.
Like, you're asking a reporter about, you know, political reporter about business, like, don't listen to anything I have to say.
Well, I mean, every single report, they give this guidance that actually our advertising is going to decrease by more than we predicted last time. And, you know, they've had this increase in subscribers. Everyone has this notion around subscribers are better for basically like honest journalism. I think it's the exact opposite. I think that, you know, as a function of the business model, when you talk about having that kind of like middle ground, and I know that you said that it's better that the pretenses are dropped, which I agree with and we'll get into, but in terms of having like someone, like at least the Associated Press, which obviously has gone off the rails, but having someone who could be just the driest, blandest, just the facts type wire, I think that advertising is an important piece of that. Maybe it's the syndication piece for in terms of the Associated Press, but I mean, do you think that there should be some any type of middle ground, or is it just the drop the pretenses and then we're good to go?
In an ideal world, I suppose it would be nice to have a mainstream media, but we don't live in an ideal world. They're no longer really mainstream. And so I'd rather have no pretenses than pretenses, I think. And I just, you hear a lot of people like who are very pessimistic about the sort of the dissolution of traditional media. And look, I think there are drawbacks and benefits to both models. I think very much I go back to Rathergate, the mainstream that was supposed to be neutral and even-handed was driving an agenda, and there were not that many opportunities to expose that. It was a huge deal when they were fact-checked and they were exposed. And I think now we see that all over the place, and everybody can pick and choose a source of media that supports their preconceived notions. And do I think that's great? No, but there are drawbacks and benefits, I think, of both models.
Yeah, I think the through line that you alluded to is the difference between partisan attacks and real reporting that comes from a point of view, right? So you're talking about, like, we do real reporting that actually goes through the steps of being a reporter, like you learn in J school, and we verify that everything is correct. It's just that story selection is probably the biggest function of bias. And that is where our bias is coming from, that everything we're telling you is true. It's just that it's a really big world and we choose to focus on these issues. Is that basically what you're saying? Opposed to just like, here's this attack.
I think that's exactly right. And, the reporters at the Beacon don't write polemics. They're not writing opinion. And it's actually something I hound them about. You have to show rather than tell. That's like a dictum that lots of reporters have been told and try to heed. But if something's bad, like, it's not good enough to say it's bad. You need to show and persuade people through an assembly of facts that it's actually bad or corrupt or whatever the case may be.
Yeah. So you were the chief White House correspondent at Politico.
Not chief.
Okay. White House correspondent at Politico. You're still in the thick of things. When you're playing at kind of like the highest level of journalism there, how rigorous is that process of what you're doing? And, you know, I guess, like, you know, what are the insights that you took away from, you know, working at the White House and running that beat?
I think the rigor is largely, at least I felt, was sort of self-imposed. And one thing I noticed in the Trump administration and in general is there's a lot of room to be sloppy when you're attacking Republicans, or if you were attacking Trump. Like, you're not going to get the same public, and when I say public, I mean sort of elite blowback if you're saying something negative about Trump. And so in that way, I think the rigor, it wasn't all that rigorous. I feel rigor at the Beacon when I know that every one of these stories or many of them will be scrutinized and our opponents are out there looking for ways to discredit us. So I think that is an advantage of being an underdog.
Pressure breeds diamonds, right? Is essentially what you're saying. In terms of people not focusing on the sloppiness towards Trump, I mean, in the last couple weeks,
the whole Russia dossier story is an example of that, where like one story fed another, and they were all sort of sloppy, and there's just not like, there's not there. So what did any of these reporters lose by doing that? Like they're not shamed by their colleagues in the mainstream. In fact, many of them have been promoted and gone on to bigger posts and better pay. I just think the incentives were sort of to collect the most outrageous set of details that make, you know, Trump and his aides look as bad as possible. And there's also no punishment for failure. Or for getting it wrong, I would say for getting it wrong.
Yeah, I think that that's kind of like a core piece of the narrative monopoly, is that there is a narrative or a monopoly on these narratives. And if there wasn't, then you would see some blowback. I mean, the Washington Post just issued these two corrections, one of which was like this video that we posted of Trump, telling the Secretary of State in Georgia to go find votes was like actually doctored. Or something like that. Did you see that? It was like a paragraph of a correction like 4 months later.
I did see that. I mean, that's a good example. And one of the things I've been attuned to now is in the coverage of this police shooting of a 16-year-old girl, and I believe it was Columbus, Ohio, like the media is spinning its own narrative about what happened here, as opposed to saying like, look, from the perspective of her and her family, like this is absolutely a tragedy. On the other hand, like put yourself in this police officer's shoes. Here are the facts he was dealing with. And like, this is a tough and messy situation. That's not what we're getting. Instead, we're getting a tendentious presentation of the facts designed to lead the viewer, the reader, whatever, to the conclusion that we have an epidemic of like police racism, of which this is an example.
I think the crazy thing is I'm totally fine in both of these scenarios. Like I'm totally fine criticizing President Trump. Like I've done it on this podcast before. I think there's plenty to work with, and I don't understand why. I mean, I do understand, but it's just crazy that there needed to be this extra layer. And then in terms of what you're talking about, it's the same thing. Like there obviously are many instances of police brutality that on their face can be dealt with, but you don't need to spin a narrative where this officer basically saves this girl's life by stopping her from getting stabbed into like the same thing as George Floyd. It's just crazy to me. It's like, stop trying to manipulate all of this information. I just want the facts is basically what I want. And I don't see the trend reversing.
I don't either. I mean, I think, in fact, the trend we're seeing is like more towards the problem is it's like the inmates running the asylum. So it's the youngest and most liberal employees of the New York Times are exercising enormous influence over the institution as opposed to being shaped by the institution. And this is something that Yuval Levin, AI scholar in his book,
is coming on the podcast soon.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. So he writes about that. It used to be that you would go into these institutions and you would learn like, how does the New York Times work? What's its style? And in turn, you would be shaped by having been at the New York Times. Well, now like we have college students coming in who say they know better than the Times leadership, and the Times leadership agreeing to them, as opposed to saying like, look, we do things a certain way around here for a reason. And also Times leaders and Post leaders, doesn't matter, I mean, it's happening at every paper, conceding that, they're intrinsically racist and flawed and really handing the reins over to people who don't really know very much about very many things because by virtue of being in their 20s.
I have a friend who we'll say works in a very like traditional structural job of hierarchy where, you know, the oldest person is the boss and it kind of goes down the chain and you do what your boss tells you. And he's always asking me, like, how is this stuff happening? Because it's not just media. I mean, it's kind of across the board, but how is it happening that people in their 20s are dictating the decisions made at the highest levels of these companies and no one is telling them, like, you know, this is how it goes here. And not just this is how it goes here, like explaining the why behind it. I mean, there's no, like all of that institutional knowledge in, let's say, the New York Times built up of the gray lady of reporting, that is just being completely erased in a matter of 10 years.
I think it probably began a little bit before that. But I agree. And I would add that, like, you know, in a leadership position, it's not that you just say like, hey, this is the way things go here. Like, I've learned from, you know, some painful learning experiences, like, the best leadership is collaborative. Like, you do want to be asking people their point of view, but it's to make clear that, like, ultimately I'm going to make the decision, you know, after hearing everybody's point of view. And I think at places like the Times and elsewhere, you literally see them reversing decisions that were made because of public pressure. And another thing I'm astounded by, and this happened with a Washington Post reporter a couple of weeks ago, essentially publicly excoriating and shaming her bosses. You know, so it's one thing to hear the complaints of somebody, and if that person doesn't like the way it is, they're free to leave for another job. It's another thing, I think, to shame and try to humiliate your bosses, and the bosses, like, they don't do anything. They don't react.
I don't get it.
And
yeah,
you know,
I don't get it.
Like, that's the end of the road for this person. Like, they're actively undermining the institution. But it's a phenomenon.
Yeah. And you, so, you know, doing my homework here, you know, you had a stint with CNN, and you know, once they found out that you were no longer in the quote unquote mainstream media, you know, what happened there?
I was with CNN for a couple of years when I was covering the White House. And I will say that, like, there was a huge glut of bringing on analysts when the Trump administration turned politics into entertainment. And so I was among the cohort of White House correspondents who really got lucky to be offered a financial opportunity to, like, you know, do my job. So there were a lot of people hired whose contracts have now ended because there's just isn't as much public interest or obsessive interest in the White House. But I had given CNN a heads up a couple days before the Beacon announced that I would be joining. And so they knew of the change. And just the day that it became public, I was told they won't be renewing my contract. And look, they are, like, nobody's entitled to a television contract. Many people's have ended for reasons other than they didn't go to conservative media. But in the statements of the CNN, you know, CNN's comms guy made a statement that I was pursuing a different line of work or moving to a different career. And I think it was very clear to me that they did not have an appetite for somebody, you know, a right-leaning, an openly right-leaning reporter. And I think you can see that across the network. There are other conservatives who used to appear on the airwaves who don't very much anymore. I think, you know, Mary Catherine Hamm comes to mind.
This comes back to the pretense, right? I mean, if you want to have an ideological outlet, I mean, that's fine. This is America. And you should be able to amass the talent that channels your views. But I think, again, like, CNN is supposed to be this ostensibly neutral platform that is in every airport in America, which is a terrible idea, by the way, because they literally just sell fear. And, like, the one time I don't want to be anxious is, like, before I'm about to barrel through the air at 30,000 feet. But, you know, you would think that they would bring on other voices just to have a debate. I mean, that's the whole thing behind this podcast, is conversations outside the narrative monopoly. You know, I'm a capitalist. I will talk to any socialist and hear what they have to say, just because I want to understand. And I wish that there was more of that on cable. I mean, I think it's all of cable news, to be honest, but CNN is just...
For sure. This is not a problem unique to CNN. And I think when you say CNN is ostensibly, you know, down the middle, I think it's pretty clearly not that. There was a decision made, I would guess, by the president, Jeff Zucker, that this is going to be a left-wing network. And that's very much what it is, which is fine. They are, you know, I think they're to the left of MSNBC and have fewer interesting heterodox voices on their air. And, like, Fox News is, you know, basically another train wreck of a different ideology.
I mean, if we want to, we'll break some news here for the 10 people in the world that care about this. I would ban cable news. Like, if I was king for a day, I would 100% I would ban cable news. I'm like, all right, it's done. It's like, it's worse than smoking for the public health, or at least put a Surgeon General's warning.
You know, cable news, like you watch it, I guess I watch it, but the number of people who actually watch, like in a country of 300 million people, like 2 million people are watching Tucker Carlson. That's really not that many people. So yeah, it exerts some influence, but among a very small set of people.
So I got this information from someone who's kind of in the know in the media business that may be true, but cable news is like their power is so outsized because not only do they have the agenda setting power, but everyone who works for a print now online outlet, they all want to go on cable, and that's where their real power lies. Is there truth to that? Is that kind of the game being played?
I think that's true. It's sort of seen as a mark of success in a lot of newsrooms, because what cable offers is if 2 million people or 1 million people or 500,000 in the case of these daytime shows are watching CNN, that's a lot of reads for a print article. Like the print articles are getting an even less traction in most cases. And so it's a way to help like spotlight your employers, spotlight the work you're doing. And it's free. So of course, a lot of newsrooms look kindly on seeing the work, either their reporters, which are their commodities, or the work of their reporters highlighted on cable networks.
It's a crazy world out there. Let's switch gears here. You know, you alluded to this in the beginning that you are covering the Biden administration, and you certainly have the spotlight on them. So let me get a little bit of the State of the Union. I'll leave it completely open-ended and then we'll dive into specifics. Like what are you making of this first, I hate the first 100-day thing, but it is we're almost at the end of the first 100 days.
I am making that. I think Biden's effective and concerted portrayal of himself as a reasonable moderate on the campaign trail was effective politics that belies what we're seeing, the politics we're seeing out of the White House. They clearly are extremely ambitious. I think they welcome comparisons to FDR and other transformative presidents, and whether they succeed or not, like they have very small majorities in both houses of Congress, but whether they succeed, those are their goals. Like the extent to which they can succeed at those goals remains to be seen.
Now, is that because of the tailwinds of kind of the progressive movement moving the Democratic Party left over the last few years and them being, you know, like AOC or Bernie Sanders, like their language is so much more ambitious than, you know, the kind of like the average Democrat over the last 10 to 15 years? Or is it because Biden has kind of just been this guy who has really had this vision for a long time? I mean, what's driving that?
I think part of what's driving it is, look, Republicans are favored to take back the House in 2022. The Senate is anybody's game. And there is a sense among like the smart people in the Biden White House that they have 2 years to get done, like to cement a legacy. I do think he's unlikely to run again, but I think, they want to use whatever momentum they have, because 2 years from now, they may not get anything done between 2022 and 2024.
So is that the game now that, each administration only has 2 years and then it's just defensive posture, start campaigning? Is that going to be the future of American politics?
Well, I think by being ambitious in the first 2 years, like Biden gets to placate the left in many ways. And also it's a nod to political reality. It's not just reading a history of the Reagan administration that noted that presidents' second terms are often less successful than their first terms, like the challenges and troubles accumulate. So I think that they are rightly understanding that they have about 2 years to get something done. I don't agree with many of their objectives, but I think you can feel the sense of like in both foreign and domestic policy of a sense of urgency.
What has he left in place from the last administration? And specifically, you know, stuff that he may have said that he was going to change, but they've quietly
That's
not
the good
changed it.
Question. I think broadly, we'll have to see, but they do seem to have adopted the China policy, you know, not wholesale or anything, but to have adopted the Trump view that like China is a geopolitical adversary and we need to be doing things to counter their aggression. That's the one that stands out to me. Are there others you can think of? I'm sure I'm overlooking many of them.
You know, I had read that they,
before I forget, I think that like on the border, they're going to end up with policies. Either they're going to pay a political price or they're going to end up with policies like that they unwillingly, Trump policies that they unwillingly revert to.
Now, I listened to Dan Crenshaw on Joe Rogan. That was like a, you know, big episode. He was talking about how there was some decision made about like the asylum policy or something like that, that the Biden administration reversed. And like, that's the reason why is that, that there's a surge on the border right now. Is that a talking point or is there truth to that? Like what is going on right now at the border?
It's a good question. We really are seeing a rapid uptick in the number of migrants crossing the border and particularly in the number of unaccompanied minors. So they've ended up with a whole bunch of young kids, you know, some are teenagers, 17, but others are young kids like 8, 9, 10. I'm told the cartels have stepped up their activity down there. And that is essentially, I think, because Biden broadcast on the campaign trail that his policies were going to be more softer and more welcoming than those of the Trump administration. So look, you'd have to be an idiot, like not to, I think people have taken advantage of that and you can't blame the migrants for it. I would note also that the country is not equipped to process and house and deal with this. So these kids are ending up often in facilities that either there's very little adult supervision or the condition, like they're under construction, the conditions aren't what they should be. But I also think like the media has covered this a bit, but it's not the relentless, you know, close up footage. There was like a week of coverage and I would expect more given that it's not clear to me exactly what the Biden administration has done to ameliorate the situation that is having deleterious effects on young Hispanic children.
Is there truth to the whole like not the kids in cages thing is now the same exact scenario except they rebranded it as migrant facilities or something, or have they actually increased the living conditions?
The Trump administration had an explicit policy of saying, if a parent comes over with a minor, we are going to separate them. The Biden administration is not doing that. So it's less like an explicit, and Trump's did that. It was I think a ham-handed attempt to deter people from bringing kids across the border. So the Biden administration, they have kids coming without adults in many cases. And so what the difference is that there's not an explicit policy of separating parents from children. And therefore, I think less of a focus on children ripped out of their parents' arms. I think that probably is happening less, actually.
Yeah, it's so hard to follow this stuff and actually get the info. So I'm glad that you give me that update. In terms of the quote unquote infrastructure bill, and if there's anything else I'm forgetting here, you know, please chime in. But the infrastructure bill is kind of like the one thing that I think is on everyone's radar. The infrastructure that's not actually infrastructure bill. Which is like turned into a meme now, which is pretty hilarious. What are the odds of that actually passing and like, you know, what are the next steps? I'm really not in tune on this.
To say, I think I'm not following it super, super closely, but it is a like boondoggle of a bill that contains some money for infrastructure and a lot of money for other left-wing hobby horses. And I do think that there's a chance, maybe it's not 1.9 billion, but they have majorities in both houses of Congress. So long as the administration and Democratic leaders, Schumer and Pelosi, can keep their various conferences united, the bill, I think, will pass. The question is, look, AOC and the squad, they want something bigger. And the question is, can, and also the state and local tax bailout for East Coast states, there's a controversy about that. So will Democrats defect? Like, ultimately, no, I don't. I think that they will be able to keep people together, but we are seeing debates bubble up over whether they're going to lose a faction over some of the debates occasioned by the items in this bill.
So it's 1.9, you're saying 1.9 trillion. Is there like an upper range of 6 trillion? Because I have 6 trillion in my mind for some reason.
I don't believe I've seen that, but again, okay. You know, talk about the media. This is not my area of expertise.
Do you think, all right. So one more hot take then. Do you think that there's any merit to this like Supreme Court commission that Biden put together? Do you think that it's just kind of like a, here's my action item, and you know they're gonna say that the Supreme Court should not be packed, as we all learned in schools, or we should pack it?
Look, I mean, who knows what they'll say, but like, there's a joke in Washington.
I want the take.
What do you do when you want an issue to die? Like, you create a commission to study it. That's basically what Biden did. There's no way he's going to. I mean, I don't think that they're gonna pack the court. It is interesting. You're seeing this effort on the left to redefine court packing, saying like what FDR did wasn't court packing and this isn't court packing. Actually, the Republicans packed the court because they confirmed all these judges. I mean, this is like sore loser of Democrats who are upset that the conservative legal movement and President Trump and Mitch McConnell were tremendously successful at nominating and confirming conservative judges. Often we're willing to be hypocritical while doing it. The not confirming Merrick Garland and confirming Amy Coney Barrett is a good example, but I think they're guided by the understanding that power doesn't matter if you don't use it when you have it. So I think McConnell demonstrated, like, when he has power, he's going to use it. And if the power is not to bring Merrick Garland and to bring Amy Coney Barrett, that is what he will do. The debates that are ridiculous to me are like trying to justify the hypocrisy. And it's like, of course they're hypocritical. They're politicians. Like, we know, you know, what the end goal is here.
Yeah. Hypocrisy is not necessarily unconstitutional. Last time I checked.
We expect that of our politicians.
Yeah. It's kind of like comes with the territory. All right. So let's talk about the GOP now. So the primary, which has not officially started, but is kind of starting already, the jockeying. What I'm interested in is putting this in perspective of what's going on now. You know, how much of an impact is that going to have down the line? And using like historical examples of whatever happened in like 2009 or 2005, that type of jockeying, like how does that affect, you know, 2-3 years down the line?
I don't really think we know, because 2016 is a good example. Like, how many, like, lots of people were planning and strategizing. And then I think very few people expected Trump to run, and he announced his entry, and it was like nothing before that really mattered. I think one of the calculations you're seeing is that Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley clearly made the calculation 4 years out from the next election in between November 2020 and January 2021, that they needed to object to the results of the election to gain a foothold among the 2024 Republican primary electorate. And maybe that's right, maybe it's not right. I just don't know. But certainly, I think that people are calculating and making decisions based on that. I just think that we control less than we think we control, and it's more difficult to see how these things will actually play out than it might seem.
Well, in terms of getting a temperature check on the field, I mean, let's say that for running this simulation, we're going to turn the variable of another Trump-like figure or even Trump into a constant. And we're going to say that there is no shooting star this time. You know, I feel like following this, I'm not following this that closely, but, you know, when I do tune in, it feels like you know, maybe 4 or 5 months ago, Nikki Haley was like a front runner. Now Ron DeSantis is a front runner, but Haley is not. Haley's stock is falling. You know, I did see that she said she wouldn't run if Trump ran, which I guess is like an insurance policy.
None of these people Trump runs, okay? Like, probably. I think if he doesn't, it will be huge. And it's right. I mean, Ron DeSantis is having a real moment. I did think, like, boy, if I were him, I would not want, you know, Ross Douthat at the New York Times and National Review and the Free Beacon and everybody saying, like, he's the next Trump, because we're 3 years out and a lot of things can change. And it's, like, dangerous to be the consensus candidate of the elites. Like, probably not where you want to be, I think, given the elites, the track record of the elites in, like, getting their designated candidate the nomination. But DeSantis definitely having a moment, and part of what I think you're seeing is like a function of holding office and not holding office. Like, Nikki Haley and Mike Pompeo are no longer in office, and as a result don't have the same platform that they used to, whereas Ron DeSantis is the governor of a state that has been a focal point during COVID pandemic. He has to run for, he will run for re-election next year. And I think there are a lot of people in Florida motivated to spread damaging information about him, particularly the Rick Scotts of the world and the Marco Rubios of the world, who are also probably looking at presidential runs out of Florida. And it's tough to say, like, what will happen between now and 2 years from now.
The frame of reference I have from the limited information here is Chris Christie. Right. I mean, wasn't he like a shooting star? And then all of a sudden, you know, what is it? Bridgegate happens. Yeah. And
right. Right. You just don't really know. And I remember when I started covering 2016, I mean, Scott Walker was somebody that it's like, you sort of forget about him now, but a lot of people had a lot of faith in Scott Walker because, like DeSantis, he'd fought some impressive battles at the state level, particularly over right to work and unionization efforts. And he was like, he was heralded for all that work. And then I think it just showed that for politicians, transitioning from the state level to the national level is challenging. And a lot of the politicians who are successful at the state level just don't have what it takes to be successful at the national level.
The one take I have that a lot of my friends can back me up and verify me on was I said that Scott Walker was doomed the moment he started saying bold like every 10 seconds. That's I've mentioned this on this podcast before, but anytime a politician says the word bold, I'm shorting the stock like 100%. Like, that is a consultant word. There's nothing behind it. It's poll tested.
I also thought Walker was doomed from very early on. And I remember a Republican pollster telling me that I personalized things too much, which I'm definitely guilty of. But I was not impressed with his staff, like very, you know, years out from the 2016 race. I thought his staff was unimpressive. He proceeded to hire, I think, an relatively unimpressive campaign team. And I do think like personnel says a lot about, you know, it certainly did in the Trump administration. But I was similarly bearish on Walker.
Now to kind of throw it back to the beginning of the conversation, when you talk about DeSantis and how all of these elite outlets are now covering him, is that part of the game behind the scenes where you could have like, you know, some of his competitors not maybe leaking information, but prodding these outlets to cover him? Or is that too
conspiratorial? I think we're a little that, but certainly like that'll be, you know, when the 2024 jockeying begins in earnest, I think we'll see more of that from lots of people. Look, there are multiple people who served in the Trump administration who are going to run or who are likely to run. And they know a lot about like the internal debates and the machinations of people. And so I suspect we'll see, we'll relive many of the Trump administration's like debates and scandals through the eyes of some of the candidates, whether it's Mike Pompeo or Nikki Haley or others. I suspect that'll be part of it. But look, ultimately, I do wonder how much it really, ultimately, these people are going to go before the voters. And the extent that being like crowned the next Trump by the New York Times matters, I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure how much that matters once Iowans and New Hampshireites and South Carolinians are seeing these candidates regularly.
On this podcast, you know, when I had Josh Holmes on, he made the point that a lot of times what you see is people trying to fight the last war, and nobody's ever gotten elected on somebody else's platform or momentum. I think that that's probably a negative sign for a lot of these people who are just trying to duplicate what Trump did.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And it's something that Trump never did. He wasn't like trying to capture X's voters. He was his own person creating his own voters. And I do think like nobody can outdo the king. And so I do think it's going to be difficult for some of these candidates to be like the inheritor of Trump, just because it's like self-limiting in a certain way. It's true. The goal should be to create real like Cruz voters or DeSantis voters or Rubio voters. Not like, how do I contort myself into the positions that I think the Trump voters want to see?
All right. Last question on this topic. Do you think that the whole kind of like wonky intra conservative debate around like what Orrin Cass and like these I don't know, like big government Republicans are essentially trying to do versus kind of the more traditional like cut your taxes type Republicans, like how is that going to influence this whole process?
That's a really good question, and I think that's right now it's like a great example of how ideas like bleed into politics and like begin to have an impact. So this is like a debate about essentially about capitalism and the free market that's taking place in very wonky elite conservative circles right now. But I actually think that that's going to be like one of the focal points of the 2024 campaign, because there is a genuine debate percolating on the right about this. You see like Tucker Carlson and JD Vance are the exponents of one view. And I don't think, you know, we've really seen a rush to embrace like the full-throated free market view. Like, I'm not sure who those people are going to be, but presumably there will be candidates who take that view. I think Trump made that more difficult because he wasn't a huge free market guy. He supported entitlements. He opposed like any sort of reform on entitlements. But I think what he did show, and these people are sort of spinning out from, is that Republican voters care less about, they're socially conservative and economically liberal. They like entitlements and free stuff, but culturally they're pretty conservative. And I think that was the opposite of the understanding of like, you know, Paul Ryan in 2012, where it was like, oh, well, they got to liberalize on immigration, but like, we're going to reform entitlements and cut taxes. And I think actually the opposite is more true of the average Republican voter.
I think Paul Ryan, I mean, I would love to ask him this question on this podcast. Why, you know, you spend your entire career talking about entitlements and then basically, you know, the only crowning achievement was a bill that actually increased the debt in the corporate tax cut. And I've heard this from friends who work in politics in DC that, you know, basically Trump would have signed whatever they gave him because he had no policy bona fides. Like, it was, you know, they could have sent him a bill that increased entitlement spending 100% or decreased it 100%, and he probably would have just signed it either way. So I don't understand how that whole movement,
because Trump was unpredictable in a lot of ways, and I'm not sure that he would have signed whatever they gave him. He did veto what was it, like a Russia sanctions bill, or and they overrode his veto, but he did like demonstrate that he was willing to. He didn't conceive of himself as being the leader of a party. He was just Trump. And so I don't think it really mattered what the views of the Republican senators and Republican House members were. So maybe he, you know, on a lot of things, sure, maybe he would have signed it, but Trump was fickle and unpredictable. And I think a lot of times, I remember he signed a budget. It was like a budget increase in one time. And then the coverage on Fox News he saw was like, Trump signs his budgets like bloated and this and that. And he's like, you know, never again. And I think he wanted to go back. He wanted to go back and do it differently. So he just, there was a lot of movement in the Oval Office, I think.
I can't wait to read a Robert Caro or Ron Chernow type book about the Trump administration once we've had the passage of time. But as of now, yeah, I mean, it's all conjecture. what would happen, and we'll see if he decides to throw his name in the hat again. That would be pretty crazy.
The one thing I'm going to prognosticate on and say I don't think it will happen.
Okay, that's the closing prediction here. Well, we're gonna have to have you on again once this stuff starts heating up more, and if they actually do get moving on the infrastructure that's not infrastructure bill. But any closing thoughts?
No, this has been wonderful.
Just put you on the spot there. All right, thanks, Eliana.
Thank you.